Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Anyone who's listened to this program and reads the news knows there's been controversy regarding breast and prostate cancer screening. And my guest is Dr. Saket Ambash. He's kind of a neighbor on the Alaska Regional Campus where I have an office. And I talked to him briefly about some colon cancer screening, and that led to this program. It also raises the question, and hopefully we'll address a little bit during the next hour or so, whether there's much controversy about the benefits and timing of colon cancer screening. In addition, we'll be discussing symptoms and treatment of colon cancer. You can reach us with questions or comments during the next hour or so at 550-8433. That's in Anchorage, 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 and email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Ambash's website for his office is on our website at alaskapublic.org as well, if you'd like to get a hold of him anytime after today's program. Dr. Ambash, it's a pleasure to have you come in and talk to us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Dr. Woodard. Thank you for having me. It's a privilege of mine.
Let's, you know, usually when I've talked about cancers on the program, it becomes clear pretty quickly there's multiple kinds of cancers that are affecting the organ we're talking about. I suspect the same is true of colon cancer, but tell us a little bit about the generalities. Are there more than one kind of intestinal cancer that we deal with, or is it pretty much all one kind in this situation?
Well, mostly the colon cancer is primarily that of the colon. For example, there are cancers that affect the liver where these are metastases or they go to the lungs or the brain. It's primarily colon cancer, and within it there are certain subtypes. And adenocarcinoma is by far the most prevalent. There are other subtypes, which are mucinous, signet cell. Even lymphoma can be found there, but those are very few and far in between.
So adenocarcinoma is the medical term for the most common colorectal cancer that we are going to be talking about today.
I believe that would be correct.
All right. And I'm always interested, what's the natural history of an illness? So what do we know about the development of adenocarcinoma? How long does it take to develop? What are the early symptoms and so forth that you can tell us about it?
Well, with regard to adenocarcinoma of the colon, there is a hypothesis of adenocarcinoma sequence, what we call. So essentially, assuming that there are the right environmental, genetic, or unknown predispositions, and a person develops polyps. And polyps are something that can be generally seen as a growth on the wall of the lining of the intestines, large intestines specifically. There are certain polyps which are harder to see, and they may be flat, but they grow relatively slowly for most part. And it may take anywhere from 12 to 15 years for a polyp to become a cancer. So this is a very slow-growing process, but just as people say never, there may be a subtype that is much faster growing, but for most part, we treat it as a slow-growing process.
So if I'm hearing you right, we think that the natural history of the development of adenocarcinoma of the colon is a sequence that occurs as polyps develop, and once the polyp gets going, it could take as long as 12 to 15 years to develop into a full cancer.
That would be correct. And within the polyps themselves, there are various subtypes, most common of which we describe as a tubular adenoma, and that just describes the microscopic appearance. There are glands within the lining of the intestines, and these grow, and they look like little racks of test tubes from our science class. Mm-hmm. And so that's the most common kind. And then there is a little bit more advanced, which has villous features. So they appear like villi or like brushings that are just coming out from the lining. And then even more advanced would be a villous adenoma, and those can be associated with severe diarrhea, with hypokalemia or decrease in potassium levels, and very significant diarrhea. And then from there, the step to adenocarcinoma is a smaller one than there is from the tubular adenoma.
Do we know what percentage of polyps go on to develop cancer? I'm asking is if you have a adenomatous polyp, will they all eventually become cancerous, or we don't know that for sure?
Well, let me backtrack. We know already that in the United States, the lifetime risk of developing colorectal cancer is 6%. So that's just more than 1 out of 20 people. And we also know that approximately 25 to 30% of the people above the age of 50 have polyps. So if you do the math from there, you could assume that 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 4 of those polyps may eventually become cancerous. The reality may be that it may be a smaller number yet, because as the optics with the colonoscopies improve, our ability to detect more and more polyps has also improved. There are some places where people's polyp or adenoma detection rate has been as high as 40%, which would then suggest that it's a lot more prevalent to have polyps. Mm-hmm. And the more polyps you have, and yet the rate of the cancer is still at 6%. So that might suggest that maybe 1 in 7, 1 in 8 may be really what goes on to become a cancer.
Mm-hmm. Are there different risks associated, different socioeconomic groups, different ages where you begin to start seeing these polyps?
A lot of the background information comes from what are called the actuarial tables from the life insurance companies, which kind of track the causes of death and assess the risk of how much to charge people for their life insurance coverage. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the data from them, it shows pretty much that colon cancer as a disease is hugging the zero line close to 40, and it just moves off the baseline to age 50. And from age 50, it starts taking off, and the curve or the slope of that line doubles every 10 years. So, for example, whatever the number is at age 50, then at age 60, it's double that, and at 70, it's double what is at 60, and then double that at 80. So it takes off after age 50.
So if you were going to screen for some illness, it seems to me it'd be pretty nice to have a disease you know is accelerating pretty rapidly at a certain age, and you know the natural history of how long it takes early lesions to go ahead and become malignant. Seems like it's a perfect kind of scenario for having a good screening test.
Well, there are 4 tests that usually you want for a good screening test to meet. One is it common enough?
All right, good point. Yeah.
Which in this case it is, because about 135,000 people every year are diagnosed with colorectal cancer. So that's common enough. Then do we understand enough about it, and do we have a test that can find it? Mm-hmm. So not only can we find colon cancer, but we can also find what leads to colon cancer, which would be the polyps. So those 2 criteria are met. And then what can we do about that polyp, which is to remove it? So 3, and 4, is it safe? And I would tell you yes. And number 5, is it affordable enough? And mm-hmm. it is appreciated that it makes enough of a difference that nearly all insurance companies offer some kind of screening benefits. Medicare, starting in 2004 or so, started to provide screening colon cancer screening benefits to those over 65.
So as you alluded to, like prostate or breast cancer, there may be colon cancer, adenocarcinomas that are particularly aggressive, if that's the right term. They grow very, very, very rapidly, more rapid than what the average one does. And that's where things get a little bit more difficult sometimes in making decisions.
I think that is true, but as on the whole, I think it's very difficult to make that determination from the get-go.
Okay.
And our strategy, especially when it comes to colonoscopy with screening, is that if we find a polyp, regardless of what we think it may or may not do, we just remove it.
Right.
And by doing so, we reduce the risk of colorectal cancer subsequently.
I'm trying to make this comparison back to the arguments about prostate and breast cancer, where there may be some false diagnoses, that's not adequate. This is it's a whole different ball of wax. I mean, all at one time you can remove the cancer, you can make the diagnosis pretty accurately, you can cure it. So there's not a lot of, I guess what I'm getting at in a nutshell, if we think about all the factors you've mentioned, there's not a lot of controversy about the benefit of colon cancer screening.
No, there is not. And if there is a controversy, it is how to best proceed with which of the schemes, because there are various different strategies that are considered acceptable for colorectal cancer screening. They include stool tests, and that may be for evidence of microscopic blood through the hemocult test that some people in the audience may be familiar with, where they're given cards to take home and smear a bit of their stool with a stick and do that on 3 consecutive days, not having eaten red meats and such, and that detects blood. And it can be falsely positive if someone has eaten a steak in the past 2-3 days, for example. So to improve on that, there is a fecal immunoglobulin test called a FIT test, and that is more sensitive to human blood, and that is a little bit more specific to something going on within the GI tract. So those are 2 tests, for example. And then you have 2 radiographic tests, air contrast barium enema, which is recommended every 5 years. I don't really think that there is a big role for that anymore. And part of that is because we know that in cases that you know that there is a cancer, especially in the sigmoid colon and the rectal colon, and that test will miss it 38% of the time. So if there is a known cancer and they miss it, then what's the point of doing it to look for a cancer? So I don't think barium enema is a very commonly practiced means of screening for colon cancer. Then you have virtual colonoscopy or CT colography, where a person takes the full bowel prep and undergoes a CT scan, and that can image the bowel. So those are that. And then you have 2 endoscopic approaches. One is a flexible sigmoidoscopy to be done every 5 years. And the flexible sigmoidoscopy visualizes basically a third of the colon. And since nearly half of the cancers occur in the last third, it is felt that if you don't see a polyp in the first third, then the rest of it might be okay. Now, some astute audience members may agree that that may not be a real great policy to hang your hat on. And for that, colonoscopy exists. Mm-hmm. And colonoscopy visualizes the entire colon, but no test is perfect. I mean, I've always maintained that once you come across anything perfect, just give it the tincture of time and reality sets in.
Let me remind listeners once again, my guest is Dr. Saket Ambasht, and he is a gastroenterologist here in Anchorage. Our topic today is colon cancer. We're spending a little bit of time particularly on the screening options, which we'll get into in a little bit more depth. If you've got questions or comments about anything today that you hear, you can reach us very easily. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. You can email questions over the next 50 minutes or so to line1@alaskapublic.org. You need to spell that out as one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also can take toll-free calls at 1-888-353-5752. Well, because of increased awareness, I guess, of the public of the options for screening, the ability of screening to be successful, it looks like to me from the literature I looked at that the colon cancer death rate, and not the incidence, not new cases, but the death rate's been going down for more than 20 years or so. And I think it's reasonable to expect screening has something to do with that, but also treatment. But patient awareness gets them in, gets people in, and get diagnosed earlier as well.
I think all of those are correct. Number one, I think primarily people believe that availability of colonoscopy on a much wider scale is the underlying cause behind the decrease in death rate, because the common pathway to all of those other screening modality, if you find an abnormality, is to proceed to a colonoscopy. So I think that is true. There is greater awareness, but then, you know, it is also true that among Americans between ages of 50 and 75, I guess the target audience, if you will, about a third of the people, so about 33 million people in the United States, have not had their colon cancer screening. And that may be due to several factors, one of which is, I think, lack of information out there, the fear of the procedure, or some horrible story they have heard from their friends or whatnot.
And I guess it's reasonable to say this is a cancer that is highly, I'm not sure, I guess the word's preventable. It's certainly curable and is certainly discoverable early and because of that, treatable relatively effectively. So this is all good stuff, good information.
Yep, I think all of those statements are correct. You know, number one, it is highly treatable. Earlier, the better.
Right.
It is known that early stage colon cancer, if detected early, when it has not spread and it's localized to the wall of the colon, you can expect that the cure rate may exceed 90%. If it has gone on and spread to the liver, you're lucky to find less than 10 people alive 5 years out of 100. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely deadly and very unforgiving if ignored. I think your second point, that is it preventable, I believe that answer is also true because there are data out there that suggest that a single colonoscopy will decrease the likelihood of death from colon cancer by 50% as a minimum. Mm. Some studies have suggested up to 70%, but that may be a little too optimistic.
Right. Do we know whether the incidence of new cancers are occurring more commonly than in the past? So we have this very good diagnostic technique and cancer deaths are going down. And it's commonly thought that something in our environment, foods, additives, so forth, are causing cancers. I'm not going to talk about general cancers, but can we make a comment about colon cancers? Do we know whether the numbers are increasing for the same age groups?
I don't believe that is so. I mean, it may be that we detect more cancers because of availability of good tests. But I think if the incidence of cancer had changed, that would be different. Now, there's essentially only one demographics, if you will, where the rate of cancer has increased, and that's in African Americans. And it's unclear as to why that is. I mean, the easy answer is, well, it has to do with access, but I'm not entirely sure if that is the whole story there.
I think as we talked before we came on the air, there's some evidence that colon cancers in the black population is even maybe more aggressive, despite being more common. Is that fair to say?
I think that's also very fair to say. As a matter of fact, the whole issue of when to start screening, there is some discordance, disagreements between societies. And there's one particular society that has recommended that really in African Americans, the initial average risk colon cancer screening needs to be initiated at age 45. Now, that is not widely accepted. And it is a disease equally or nearly equally affects men and women. So for every 100 men, you have 91 women who are diagnosed with colon cancer. Among African Americans, that ratio is 1 to 1, which means for every 100 men, you've got 100 women. Mm-hmm. So it's more prevalent in women. The women, African American women specifically, their cancers tends to be deeper or on the right side of the colon. So if you were to rely on a flexible sigmoidoscopy as your primary colon cancer screening tool, you may miss some that would be found otherwise.
Well, a couple of questions came up from what you were just saying. Is one, I want to come back to who is it recommended to screen, at what age and what group of people, at what time is it recommended to do the screening. But before we get there, I wanted to back up just a second, maybe to help people understand this ability of this cancer to become more aggressive and once it metastasizes, cause trouble. So this is a lesion of what's called the mucosa of the colon. And when I talk about mucosa to patients in my office, I just open up my mouth and show them the inside of my mouth. So that's mucosa. And then underneath that mucosa, there's different tissues. So you can get into muscles and blood vessels and so forth. So as these polyps become more aggressive, they may erode or grow into deeper structures in the intestine. And that is the beginning of this metastasis or movement into more serious kinds of disease. So catching it before it becomes more invasive is part of the issue here.
Right. There's a local extension. So as you said, the inner lining is the mucosa. So the lining next to it is the submucosa. It's slightly deeper. Then you've got two layers of muscle, muscularis propria, and the other one I can't remember. And then the fifth is serosa. So early on, the cancer may be just confined to the mucosa or submucosa, and then it extends down deep into the muscularis, and that's where you get into the blood supply, the nerve, and once it hits that area, it could potentially extend into the lymphatics, into other blood vessels, into the nerve system. And then if it breaches the serosa layer and extends, then it can also then by way of blood travel to other distant organs. And I think central to this theme of cancer is this concept of monoclonality. It's basically if you were to take every cancer cell of one type, for example, colon cancer, if it has metastasized, although it goes to the liver, if you were to look under a microscope, that tissue will look exactly like the colon tissue in every which way as the tumor one would. So there's a concept of monoclonality. There's a concept of immortality of those cells, that they just do not die as the normal tissue is programmed to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and most normal tissues don't seed elsewhere and don't develop their own blood supply. Well, that's not necessarily true, I guess. But they don't. Most cells in our body don't migrate around and reestablish themselves in other places.
No, and and there is a factor called angiogenesis, growth factor, right. And basically tumor cells circulate that in order to preferentially drive blood supply to them so that they can get bigger.
So there's a number of factors that I'm beginning to understand as I interview experts like yourself on cancers that that are happening, genetic changes that allow these cells to act very much different than other normal cells in our body. Most of our cells have programmed death. They die, they regenerate, but they don't live forever. They don't metastasize. They don't cause their own blood supply to be formed. And so they're distinctly something else different genetically going on with these cells. All right. We're just about through our halfway mark. But before we move on and take our break, I want to ask just briefly, if you don't mind, just tell us the general recommendations for bowel cancer screening. What age, what population, what's the recommendations that the experts are saying now?
Okay. First is a realization that screening means no symptoms. So when I have someone who says, oh, yeah, I exercise, I eat healthy, look at me, I'm not on any medication, I don't need this. And I said, no, precisely, you are the kind of guy or gal who needs it because you're doing everything you can to maintain good health. So having said that, and there are absolutely no symptoms, and we can talk about that a little later as to what the symptoms are, but age 50 is a good one if there are no other increased risks. Now, if there are first-degree relatives, those related to you by blood, have had colorectal cancer, then that screening begins at age 40. There is also a concept of what's called genetic anticipation, where every subsequent generation, the disease will strike a little sooner. So, for example, you've got someone with colon cancer at age 53, then 40 would be the recommendation for their family members.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about those symptoms, then we'll get into some of the specifics of the screening. I know we've had a couple of emails asking about coverage with insurance and the procedures themselves, and I'll be glad to ask Dr. Ambosh about those if you'll just hang with us for a little bit longer. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our discussion on the symptoms and treatment and screening tests of colon cancer with Dr. Saket Ambosh. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We're discussing symptoms, treatment, and screening of colon cancer with Anchorage gastroenterologist Dr. Saket Ambosh. If you have questions or comments, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call locally at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can always go on our website at alaskapublic.org. I'm just reminding you as well, you want to use that if you're listening to a taped rebroadcast between 9 and 10 on Monday evenings, because we're not going to be available to answer that. Also, Monica, our engineer, points out that you can do a drive-up flu shot at Alaska Regional Hospital, and I'm not sure she was joking or not, but you get a free windshield cleaning at the same time. So those of you who need and believe strongly, like Dr. Ambosh and I do, that you need to get the flu shot every year, that's one really good option to take advantage of. All right. What are the common symptoms colon cancer. And I'm quick to pick up on your point that screening is not done with people who have symptoms. Screening is done to pick up people who have yet to know they've got problems. But what would make you suspect or worry or have patients really, you'd want them talking to you if they had these symptoms suggesting possibly colon cancer?
Well, the most common symptom is rectal bleeding, which unfortunately also shares a pretty common symptom for hemorrhoids. And a lot of people tend to attribute that to hemorrhoids. Oh, it can't be anything else. And I think it's a lot of wishful thinking. And for most part, they may be right. I mean, 90% of the time, you may be right. But as you get older, I think the equation needs to include the possibility of something more serious wrong. Without scaring anybody, I mean, all of us have seen or known people who, you know, everyone knows about Daryl Strawberry at age 33 getting colon cancer. That's a rare event, and that's why it's a big deal. But that doesn't mean that everyone who is 25 years old or 30 years old who's got rectal bleeding. But if it is persistent in a very young person, I would certainly encourage them to go in and be seen. And for anybody over age of 40, I mean, I think that automatically buys a diagnostic colonoscopy because of the risk. So that's the most common one. Another one is change in bowel habits. And that has to do with the behavior of how the cancer appears on the left side of the colon versus the right side of the colon. And generally, on the left side of the colon, the tumor grows in a circumferential or ring-like manner. So the entire tube around is involved. So as it advances, it will, on an X-ray or a CAT scan, give an appearance of a napkin ring or what we commonly call as an apple core. So narrowing or thinning of the caliber of the stool or change in the bowel habits, that's very commonly seen. Now, in the right side of the colon, the tumor behaves a little bit differently and grows more like a cauliflower on a stalk, if you will. And because the function of the colon is to take what's liquidy waste product from the right side and then suck out or absorb as much of the water as possible, then as the stool content moves from right side to the left side, it becomes more solid. So for left-sided colon cancers, you get more of the obstructive type symptoms. And certainly another late symptom from, say, right-sided colon cancer would be anemia, losing blood more so than what the body can compensate for, leading to lightheadedness, weakness, fatigue. So, and unfortunately, it's not any one of these things are not just, oh, you have this particular symptom, it must be that. So it requires thorough evaluation, and seeking a medical appointment probably should be the very first step.
And unfortunately, there's no reason why you can't have hemorrhoids and colon cancer.
Well, as I said, it's a pretty common kind of a cancer.
Right.
So that is, yeah, two common events can occur.
Is there any particular way, you know, physicians, I'm being a pediatrician, I'm not thinking about colon cancers a lot. We do see occasionally some polyps in kids. But I'm thinking physicians are in the same boat that the patient is. We don't want to miss the diagnosis yet. We don't want to go through unnecessary procedures. Are there hints about the kind of bleeding? You mentioned consistent or persistent bleeding. Pain with defecation? Any other things that give us some ideas about helping figure this thing out?
Unfortunately, I don't think any of these are reliable. But certainly, you know, if you see, say, a big old hemorrhoid that pops out and it bleeds, okay, it's that.
Yeah.
And then when the hemorrhoid resolves and you continue to bleed and you've lost 5 pounds of weight or 10 pounds of weight, while everyone wants to lose weight, but if it is unintentional, then that should be a point of worry, especially if there's a 10% body weight loss. I have come across a number of people who have unsuccessfully tried to lose weight over decades, and then out of nowhere, they walk for 15 minutes and have lost 70 pounds of weight and are happy. I'm very worried because that's not normal at that point. But, the human mind is sort of, it plays tricks. Very famously, when I was in medical school, the chief of epidemiology, the guy who taught us associations between diseases and such, he had given us a lecture one day. He was 53 years old from New Zealand, ate red meats all his life, and he had, he said, rectal bleeding for years that he attributed to hemorrhoids. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't till his wife saw some blood on the toilet that she basically forced him to go to the doctors. Mm-hmm. And he had inoperable rectal cancer. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm just going to tell you that me being a doctor doesn't make me not right. human in my behavior.
Absolutely.
And he said that I want you to remember me, that do not treat your own family because emotions get involved, your personal stuff gets involved, and you have to seek professional opinion and keep all of this in mind. And as a final thought, he said, if you just took away my name and had told me about me, I'd say, are you silly? Of course you'd go to a doctor because this is obviously a cancer unless you prove otherwise. So I kind of remember that lesson in my mind as I carry forth with this.
All right, let's get into these screening tests a little bit more in depth. I've had a couple of emails, and maybe this last one will serve to get us going. It says, please explain the costs and benefits of colonoscopy relative to sigmoidoscopy. Is it worth extra dollars to do the colonoscopy versus the sigmoidoscopy? And I'm sure the answer is not simple. It probably depends on who you're talking to, what's the risk of the patient, what the symptoms and so forth. But how would you answer that question?
Well, I think if you don't have access to colonoscopy, then sigmoidoscopy in combination with fecal occult blood, or actually rather immunoglobulin test, would be a good combination. I think where colonoscopy is available, the strategy of doing a flexible sigmoidoscopy essentially misses half of possible cancers. So that in itself, I think, answers the question. As far as nuts and bolts of dollars and cents, I think at least in this society, we like not to writhe in pain and be comfortable with our procedure. So increasingly, flexible sigmoidoscopies are done with sedation. So there's cost involved that is common. There are facilities costs that the hospitals or ambulatory surgery centers take. And then there's a differential between the colonoscopy versus flexible sigmoidoscopy. And because of the nature of the preparation for flexible sigmoidoscopy, even if you find a polyp, you may not be able to take it out because the prep is not adequate to perform electrocautery safely. Because historically, when it was not known how important that was, electrocautery was done in people who were inadequately prepped and would have perforation of the colon from many explosions from the electricity. Mm-hmm. That does not happen anymore. Mm-hmm. But the colonoscopy prep is more complete, and you can safely, and any one of us in this community, any of the gastroenterologists, are more than capable of taking care of removing large polyps safely, and that can be done in colonoscopy. And then the other part of it is that if you find a polyp in the flexible sigmoidoscopy, you got to turn around and do a colonoscopy.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about the ability to remove the polyp in a sigmoidoscopy. So the answer to that question, that it misses half. You can't do the procedure that's necessary to remove the polyp if you find one. So it adds another procedure. But on the other side, there may take less training to do a sigmoidoscopy, and it may be all you have available in certain situations, is what I heard you saying.
Right. That is true. And what I would say is that anyone who undertakes the procedure to do, at the heart of it, will do their best to do it. So the detection of a polyp, you know, it depends on how good your equipment is, how good the prep is, and the skill of the operator. All of those play into it.
Let me take just a second again to remind listeners, my guest is Dr. Saket Ambasht. We're talking about colon cancer. We've talked about the natural history, the presentation of people with colon cancer. We've been really delving in a little bit deeper now in some of the screening techniques. If you have any questions or comments that this discussion is leaving in your mind, this is the time to call us and try to get those questions answered for yourself. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. I had another question regarding colonoscopy. It had to do with the options or levels of sedation a patient may choose. You'd mentioned that it appears that most of the time now sedation is done, but this person's kind of asking, is it an option? What are the options, for example, for sedation when you're doing colonoscopies?
Now, there are people who undergo colonoscopies without any sedation. They find it a little uncomfortable but quite bearable. And the thing with that is that if you do it without sedation, there is less economic cost, if you will, because you're not sedated. You don't have to go home. You don't have to find a buddy of yours or family members who have to take the day off to drive you back home. So there are those. But it is, in some people, could be very painful. And there's really not very good way to know. I mean, we know, for example, women who've had multiple, say, surgeries, gynecological surgeries, hysterectomies, such, for them it would be very, very, you know, possibly painful. Now, I've had some women do it without sedation. I've had some men do it without sedation. But most people do well with moderate sedation. Some people, because of their anxiety, may want any deeper sedation. My view on this is this, that colorectal cancer is an important disease that can be reduced in its impact on families, lives, and colonoscopy is important enough that if it means that to drag you in there, I have to promise you that, hey, you won't remember anything, I will make that promise and get you in there to do it. And because I think it's that important.
All right. Another question by email is the writer asked, is it true that some insurance covers screening but not treatment? So in this situation, if a polyp is found and removed, the entire procedure might not be covered. So how does insurance play this game?
Well, I find it very frustrating. I was actually reading up on it some last night, and what I read was that according to the Affordable Care Act, under that program, those private insurance companies cannot do that. Mm-hmm. But I'm not very clear whether private companies who do offer insurance outside of the ACA have to do that. Mm-hmm. And personally, you know, I'm reminded that it sounds not right, but it's not illegal. And I would say that adequate and continued public pressure is reasonable. I would just put people on the spot and say why. But essentially, it's changing the rules of the game in midstream, that you go in having no risks whatsoever, and you find something. And the whole idea is that if you find it, you can take care of it. Right. And if you take care of it, then all of a sudden they go back and say, oops, I'm sorry, we just changed the rules and here's a big bill. I frankly am appalled at that practice, but apparently it's not illegal. I would say that public movement and campaign and pressures on letters to your congressman, to your state representatives, commissioners, what have you. I think this practice is just not right, but it is not illegal. So one step may be, as a state, we decide that such a thing is illegal for people who live in Alaska, and at least that practice would cease in the state.
Are there contraindications that we should mention to colonoscopy? Is there a situation where someone is having problem enough medical problems or other issues that may prevent you from recommending going ahead with a colonoscopy?
Clearly, there are. There are some risks to colonoscopy. They're minimal. Nationally, if you look at the number, there are risks to perforation, hemorrhage, and those risks vary differently and widely if, for example, you were to take out a large polyp versus just do a screening exam. I think overall the analysis suggests that if there aren't good 5 years left in you, then the risks of the procedure may outweigh the benefit. So, for example, and that applies to screening. I mean, even if, say, someone is on oxygen, has severe emphysema, and they're bleeding out, mm-hmm. you would absolutely offer a colonoscopy and perform it to treat them. Mm-hmm. So that's a different game.
Yeah.
But for screening purposes, mm-hmm. if someone who's barely can breathe enough and requires 2-4 liters of oxygen, can't walk, and otherwise just generally is not expected to live within 5 years, it may not be worthwhile doing that.
So that just brings up again that question between colonoscopy for treatment versus colonoscopy for screening, and you want to be clear about what you're talking about. Colonoscopy may help dramatically stop somebody who's bleeding rectally, control that bleeding, and so that's a different issue than screening a 92-year-old who has got some rectal bleeding no rectal bleeding, just for a screening test.
Right.
And I was probably looking at my other screens when you said this. There are some complications. You said earlier some perforations could occur. What's the generally quoted complication rate of colonoscopies, and what are the major complications you really worry about?
Well, the complication can run a gamut, like there's some splenic rupture that has been described rarely, but these are rare events. The common ones include post-procedure bleeding. So just even if you do not take out a polyp and just do a procedure, afterwards you can see bleeding in 1 in 400, 1 in 500 people, enough that they would come back to you to have something done. That, of course, is changed or affected because there's a number of people who are on Plavix for a coronary stent. There are a number of people who take baby aspirin. They're on Coumadin. So those increase the risks. And based on individual medical condition, we may recommend stopping those medications or continuing on. And it's just a very, considered decision that we would make in conjunction with the patient. So that's one. Perforation, there was one series that quoted 1 in 400 for Medicare population countrywide. I don't understand that, and I will tell you that because if I felt that if we provided a complication rate of 1 in 400 in this town, we'd be run out. None of our colleagues have a complication rate that high. I think it's probably closer to 1 in 2,000, 1 in 3,000, that type. Mm-hmm. And that's much more reasonable, at least the way it's practiced in this state, in this town.
Mm-hmm. I think you also may have mentioned something about accuracy of colonoscopy. And this is what got my attention when I met you in the hall at near our offices. I think it's human nature maybe to just think, well, a colonoscopy is a good screening test. It's got to be pretty accurate. Nothing's 100% accurate, but it's not 100% accurate. Could you explain why it may not be 100% accurate and what are the leading factors that change the accuracy?
Well, I'm glad you asked. At first, when I joined the training 16 years ago, we were sort of taught that you could comfortably quote 97% accuracy in finding polyps. So we reasoned that there's only a 3% chance we missed something at some point. And then you say, okay, so if someone goes through two colonoscopies, there's a 99.7% chance that when you say it's normal, it's got to be normal. And we used to walk around, you know, with puffed chest, proud of ourselves. And then one summer, we were at a national meeting, and Douglas Rex, who is at Indiana University, is a professor of medicine and a lead endoscopist for research, he got up on the stage and he says, well, I'm here to tell you guys that my personal miss rate is 10%. And if any one of you guys want to go out there and say that yours is 97%, you go for it. And I think that gave permission for people to actually start looking at it.
Right.
And the way he went about it is that his patients gave permission for what's called a tandem colonoscopy. So he did the scope, and immediately following, before the person came to, another physician came in and did the scope, the same scope on the same setting. And they figured out how many or polyps may have been missed, and the number came out to be 10%. Mm-hmm. It turns out that missing significant polyps, and by significant I mean something larger than 10 millimeters or a centimeter, you know, for those who still like the English system, more than about about 4/10 of an inch or 3/8, I guess, would be a better measure of an inch polyp. Missing those is about 2%. So once he said it was 10%, then there have been other studies done, you know, and then the question comes up that if you're looking at the accuracy of the colonoscopy, why do you have colonoscopy being used as a gold standard the second time? Is there something
right.
better?
Right.
So there have been tests where CT colography has been done, and the number is probably around miss rate. I mean, I think there are some very insignificant type of polyps, which are 1 or 2 millimeters. Mm. So that's the other part. You know, as the
right.
technology
right.
has improved
right.
and the prep is taken with remarkable sincerity,
mm-hmm.
you can see polyps as tiny as a millimeter.
Wow.
That's smaller than a pinhead.
Yep.
And even those, if we see it, we remove it. So those types of polyps, it's probably reasonable to say that some people may not see it either because of limitations of the polyp, the prep or the optics that exist. But generally, it's very good.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's a very, very accurate test. I was going to ask about has anyone ever looked at these virtual CTs, which have the advantage of not being invasive. The disadvantage is when you find something, you still got to have a colonoscopy to address it. But would a virtual CT be another way to establish a standard with which to compare the accuracy of colonoscopies?
Well, the virtual CT is one of the accepted means of performing screening for colonoscopy. Mm. But the problems with it is that the prep that you take is the same as that for a colonoscopy. And if you speak with anyone who has had a colonoscopy, the biggest impediment to getting a colonoscopy is the prep. So you don't bypass that. The CT colography itself is a non-sedated procedure, and much like barium enema, they introduce a ball or something like that and introduce air into it. So it may be uncomfortable, but it's fairly well tolerated as best as I know.
You mentioned an immunologic test that does some screening, and I'm thinking, is that by others may have heard this DNA testing that's done on the stool. Is that the same thing that you're describing as the immunologic testing?
I believe that the immunological testing is a little bit different, but the DNA testing, by way of the new test that was approved recently by FDA, Cologuard, includes right. Various mutations, about 12, but it does require not just a smear of the stool, but mm-hmm. a full stool mm-hmm. sample mm-hmm. that is then collected and then put in a preservative and shipped off someplace. And they do a combination of the immunotesting as well as the DNA testing mm-hmm. for that.
Do we know the accuracy of that particular test? I mean, false positive, false negatives. Again, it's a new technology, and we may not have that much information. But.
Well, I can't quote you the numbers, but I believe both the specificity and the which is how accurately, like if it's positive, how likely is it that you're going to find a cancer? That runs around 75 to 85%, somewhere in there.
Okay. I had another email, and this is probably the last one we can do. We only have a couple of minutes, but it's, could you talk about why Alaska Native people have two times the rate of colorectal cancer than other races? We talked about this beforehand, and neither one of us, at least I didn't know specifically what the rate was. You have any? Can you comment on this? Do you have enough knowledge to answer that question?
I'm not sure if I can specifically address it, except to say that there are populations we know by epidemiological studies that populations at extremes of latitude have higher rates. So New Zealanders, for example, have a higher rate. Alaska Natives have, and one could only conjecture then that whether it has to do with lack of sunlight or whether it's because of the extremes of latitudes, you're more reliant on meat as a diet and less fruits, or is it all of it? Because there is data that suggests that vitamin D and calcium may be protective against recurrence of colorectal polyps, as well as low-dose aspirin. But what I want to emphasize here is that none of those mitigating factors are so overwhelmingly influential that one should forego a colonoscopy.
I'd like to end the program, and we've got about a minute left, with just a general comment about what you want to make sure listeners take away from the program today.
The take-home point is that if you're really healthy, you're doing well, if you care enough about checking your cholesterol, exercising, and you have not had a colon cancer screening, and you're more than 50 years of age without any other risk factors, then get in and be seen for that, because that's really the take-home points. And over the years, we have developed some quality measures, like measuring, you know, how well we do our jobs, and it's perfectly okay for you to put your endoscopist on the spot and say, hey, what are the chances? How good are you? Mm-hmm. And there are various quality measures that one can answer to that.
All right. So there's really generally for most of us no good excuse not to do it if we're in over 50 or have other higher risk situations to maybe even be earlier than that.
I agree. In 16 years, after I've done twisting my arm or other people's arms, I've had maybe three people not agree to do it.
My thanks to today's guest, Anchorage gastroenterologist Dr. Saket Ambasht. If you'd like to continue this conversation on colon cancer, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link on our website at www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the Line 1 archives and listen to this program at any time you'd like. On the next program, our guest is going to be breast surgeon Dr. Karen Barbosa of the Alaska Institute of Surgical and Medical Specialties. We're going to be discussing and focusing on surgical treatment of both benign and malignant disorders of the breast. So why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday, October 20th at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey is our web editor, audio engineer today's show, and gave us a hint about influenza vaccine that we shared with you. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.